This is Judaism Unbound, episode 55, the 365th day. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rofus.
And this is actually our 365th day of the podcast. We launched last year on March 4th, and today is March 3rd. So we're really excited to have come full circle. And actually, when we were talking to Erwin Kula last week, I thought that that was our last episode of our first year. But it turns out that by one day, this is our last episode of our first year. So I'm going to consider it our first episode of our second year.
Years Unbound.
Well, actually, right. One of our ideas has been to make some adjustments to the Jewish calendar. So I think that maybe this is the first time. So as we often do, I just want to start and open by thanking our listeners in so many ways. Not only have you supported us financially over the course of our first year, but we just love that so many listeners have sent us emails and Facebook messages and such. Actually, a really interesting thing is happening recently where listeners are recommending guests that we should have, which we love, which we think is a great idea. So please keep those coming. And we really have been influenced by a lot of the ideas from listeners who have written in, and we've brought up those issues on shows coming up. And we really, you know, doing a podcast, for me at least, is this weird experience. We'll talk about this more later, I think, but it's this weird experience of talking and you don't really know who's listening. You know that a lot of people are listening because you can see the numbers online, but you can't really know who they are. And so the idea that people write into us and contact us in other ways, we've been invited to different communities to speak. We love that because it's really a chance to get to know who's listening and to understand this community that's kind of forming here, which is not at all something that we expected when we launched the podcast. I want to, again, as we often do on these episodes, ask for your help in a couple of ways. Number one is, even though it's a year in, it's still really helpful to us if you go onto iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts and give us a 5-star rating and maybe even write us a very brief review. That helps us in the iTunes search mechanisms, and it helps people who are looking for a Jewish podcast to be more likely to stumble across ours. So that would be super helpful, as would, of course, financial support. We have all kinds of different approaches to financial support that we're looking to. You can go to www.judaismunbound.com/donate and find all sorts of different ways that you might support us, ranging from a one-time gift to an ongoing monthly support through Patreon, or you can also do that through PayPal. So we really, you know, an interesting piece on that is that we've mentioned this briefly before. We're working on a new podcast series about the Jewish holidays, and we came to realize that it's really complex to put together a new podcast series, particularly in the style that we want that one to be, which is more shorter segments and a lot of different voices coming in. And that's a complex editing job. And we realized that for us to really launch that podcast the way we really want to launch it, we probably need to hire another staff person, another editor. And at that point, we'd actually have the capacity to do even more podcasts. So we're going to release some of those episodes in the next few weeks as bonus episodes of Judaism Unbound. But we're really realizing that we can vastly increase the amount of material that we're putting out there, but we do need some substantial new support to be able to do that. So again, thanks so much for a full year of listening to Judaism Unbound, and we're going to jump into our conversation, which is really going to have a few parts. We're going to first talk a little bit about the last few episodes, and then we're going to talk about where we are thinking back on the whole first year, and both in terms of the ideas that we've been exploring and also other dimensions that we've been experiencing running this podcast for a year. And then we're going to look ahead to sort of say, well, a year in, what are the questions that are really top of mind for Lex and me right now? And we will basically be exploring those questions over the next year, along with questions that you, our listeners, are raising. So Lex, as I look back on the last few episodes with Douglas Rushkoff and Erwin Kula, it actually is dovetailing for me with this basic question that once you sort of accept the idea that we need innovation in Jewish life, whether that's sustaining innovation or disruptive innovation or both, Clayton Christensen really puts out this idea that a helpful way to think about how to put that innovation into place is to imagine that the people who are not currently participating have a job to be done in their life, and you're trying to understand in a deep way what that job is, and then ask yourself, does Judaism have the capacity to do those jobs in people's lives? And then there's a question of, are we capable of doing that job? Do we want to be doing that job? And I think that maybe that's a good place to start, because that was really a lot of what Douglas Rushkoff was talking about in terms of, you know, well, what is it that Judaism really is on a fundamental level? And where does that land on you, that question of, you know, is there a sort of essential set of things, right? He talks about iconoclasm and monotheism, abstract monotheism, and social justice.
Social justice. Yep. Yeah. I mean, so I indicated this in our conversation with Douglas Rushkoff, but this essentializing project is a difficult one for me. And what I mean by that is that basically, trying to break down Judaism into sort of that core piece or core couple pieces, that's the key and everything else sort of builds around it, is something I'm resistant to, because I struggle with whether that's historically been the case or if it is today. But given that, I think that what Rushkoff lays out with iconoclasm, monotheism, and social justice is an interesting trinity. And I use that word intentionally, because it's, of course, a religiously connoted kind of word in Christianity. But here's my question, and I want to give a shout out to a frequent listener who I speak with a lot. Hey, Chava, I know you're listening. But what we brought up with Rushkoff is the question of, is monotheism really at the core of what Judaism has been and must in the future be? And I think when we look at the has-been question, when we look at what Judaism has represented for most of its history, I think, yes, ultimately monotheism has been a characteristic of what most institutional forms of Judaism look like. Now, in virtually every era, there have been large groups of dissenters from that. In some eras, it appears Judaism may have been polytheistic. In other eras, there are plenty of Jews who would have been monotheistic. People throw around terms like henotheism to refer to how the Bible looks at gods or God. Like we have our superior God, but there might be other ones.
Okay, I've heard that as basically monolatry.
Yeah, so the henotheism and monolatry are, if my understanding is correct, very, very close to one another. I think there are some really sort of nitty gritty kinds of distinctions in the scholarly world, but I think for our purposes, it is largely, yeah, we're talking about monolatry or henotheism. So what I would ask, and what we did bring up with Rushkoff, is monotheism really sort of an eternal must-have core concept of Judaism? And for me, I'm not sure it is. And specifically in today's world, I think there's the ongoing question that we've alluded to of Jewish atheists, which are a huge portion, people who actually identify themselves as Jewish and non-believers in God. And then there's a whole, maybe even bigger group, probably bigger group, of Jews who might not call themselves atheist, who maybe they're agnostic, but maybe just God isn't really something they think about very much or relate to. And I think that that's really crucial, because right now, if monotheism is one of our three core principles, those people are certainly feeling on the margins of what Jewishness or Judaism is. And I think that could change, and I would like it to change. So basically, I want to bring that question up, which is, do we really think that if Judaism became not monotheistic, either in the sense that it adopted some other kind of ideology, or it just didn't have theology in the same way, like, would it still be Judaism? And my claim is yes. And it sounded like, honestly, even Rushkoff's claim is yes. And the reason I brought up Chava is because Chava said that in certain ways, it might be that monotheism is actually an icon. It's like this counterintuitive thing where iconoclasm, one of his other pillars, is all about taking down icons and the idea that there is something that is, you know, to be worshipped and above everything else. And maybe monotheism actually is a kind of icon in today's world, at least for many Jews. Once again, not making a claim either way that God does or doesn't exist. Like, that's my point. I don't, my mind, to be honest, on that changes daily. So I'm not comfortable like making a stance on the podcast, but just bringing up that set of questions and thoughts, because I do think ultimately we're at a juncture where forms of Judaism are coming to rise and will continue to come to rise that won't be monotheistic.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are two questions there. One is whether Judaism does have or should have any kind of essence at all. And the second is, if so, what would that essence be? Or what would be the components of that essence? And is monotheism one of them, or some version of monotheism? I mean, I want to come back to that question of whether Judaism should have an essence at all or does have an essence at all, because, you know, I think that's really a crucial question that I want to jump into. I do think, just to explore the monotheism point for a minute, I mean, I think that in my mind, the question, it raises the question, you know, is Judaism a religion? Does Judaism have to be a religion? Not is Judaism a religion, but does Judaism have to be a religion at all? And if so, if it's a religion, does it have to be monotheistic, or could it have some other kind of relationship to God? I don't know if this is kind of a useful lens, and I don't know if it's right, but I've kind of thought about Judaism throughout its history as being asymptotic to atheism, right? Meaning it always takes the next step towards atheism from what the society around it currently is, but it doesn't get all the way there. And so when you start in a polytheistic society, then Judaism seems more what you call henotheistic, right? Or monolatrous, right? So it acknowledges in the Bible, there's a lot of acknowledgement that there are other gods, but our God is the best and the only one that we should worship, you know? And then in a world in which monotheism has become largely accepted, at least in the West, Judaism develops this idea of a God who is completely hidden and functionally absent from the world. And so it's like we're even more monotheistic than you guys. And, you know, then the question becomes, right, in a world in which that sort of basically absent God is very much the experience of again, maybe in the West, of a lot of people, you know, maybe Judaism then moves to the next stage, which, like, to me is not atheism. To me, the next stage is God optional. Right, that it says, look, you know, I'm not sure that there's a big difference between a God that doesn't exist and a God that is completely hidden and not active in the world. You know, I can see ways in which there is a difference, and I'm actually curious what you think about that. But bottom line is that shouldn't be what really divides us, because even if there is a difference, it's not a very big one. And so fundamentally, we can take the next step, which is to say, God, whether it's monotheism or whatever conception of God that we have, it's not at the center of the questions anymore of what Judaism should be. And then what goes into the center becomes the most active question that we have.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I want to insert into the conversation a book that I haven't read yet, but that I've heard a lot about, which is Putting God Second, which talks a lot about these questions and the extent to which God might not need to be central in the future of Judaism. But what I want to say is
a book by Daniel Hartman from Hartman Institute.
Yeah, by Daniel Hartman. And if you remember when we had Yehuda Kurtzer on, he works for the Shalom Hartman Institute in North America. They work together very closely. But what I want to think about in terms of the current world of Judaism is, I think, in effect, we already are working in a God-optional framework. Now, what gets tricky is we don't usually name that. You don't have rabbis at the front of the room in their sermons or communities like saying forthrightly, like most at least, that you don't have to believe in God. You do have some. We talked with Labshul and we see like some communities that are very transparent about, you know, whatever your thoughts on God, you can be here. But there still is this taboo in a lot of places that, you know, certainly we know there are folks in the room who don't believe in God, but we're not going to really put that center stage. And, you know, I'm naming that because I think it continues to set a framework where basically the idea people have is that Judaism is a monotheistic religion that has some atheists, as opposed to a God optional religion that has monotheists, atheists, whatever different theists or not we are talking about. And I do agree with you very strongly that it would be more desirable for us to have a God optional framework that's not just sort of in passing, but we say so proactively. We set the tone that, you know what? We, the institutions, or we, Judaism, don't have monotheism at the core, but rather we have a historic connection to a lot of different kinds of monotheism. But today we're aware fundamentally that that's not the prevailing norm in all of our communities anymore. I think historically, the idea may have been in certain eras that if you're not a monotheist, like, okay, but you're either not going to be a part of a community, or if you are, you're sort of going to be a dissenter or a marginalized member of the community. And I want to be a little bit clearer. It's not that those people are oppressed in some big way. It's just that communities organize themselves around the proposition that monotheism is sort of the norm. And historically, that means everything from religious school education, talking about God, the character in the Torah or elsewhere as real, and not certainly with young children, but even with middle and high school children, it's often not a question of does God exist, but what kind of God exists, in my experience, even in non-Orthodox spaces. And that's not necessarily horrible, but it does set a tone that this is our norm, monotheism, and if you aren't part of it, you're still welcome here, but you're not really centralized. And I think that leads a lot of people to be less interested. And it doesn't need to be that way, in my opinion. I don't think we need to have that central proposition around which we organize.
So then let me ask you a question, because I've been meaning to ask you this for a while, but when you say, for example, that Judaism could be a God-optional religion, could you explain to me a little bit more about like how you're using the word religion? Because I asked Erwin Kula also, right, and he said that he translated religion to be what he called a technology of human flourishing. And I'm just not sure why to use the word religion, and I'm curious like what you mean by it.
So I'm glad you asked, because I do like the word religion, and I do think Judaism is and should be a religion. When I'm talking about religion, I want to make it clear that to me, religion is not defined primarily by theology. Religion, like when I say religion, I'm not talking about the category of things in the world that engage with God. Because I think when we look around at a lot of things that are called religions, Buddhism, Confucianism, Taoism, they're not really primarily concerned with questions of whether God exists or how to connect to God. They're concerned about suffering. They're concerned about, you know, all sorts of different kinds of questions, because ultimately religion as a framework is complex in that what we have referred to as religions are asking fundamentally different questions from one another and are acting in ways that differ in large ways. So when I use religion, I'm using it in a really, really broad kind of sense. I think that American civic religion is as religion-y as Judaism or Buddhism or Confucianism. I'm speaking merely about the set of systems that are meant to, so I do think, to encourage human flourishing. I like that way of looking at it that he brings up. But I think it's a little simplistic to imply that it's one set of things. I actually think back to Angie and Casper, who talked about, you know, there are sort of six categories of jobs, to use our current framework, that many institutions are doing, whether it's, you know, building community or camaraderie, whether it's engaging with important big questions. I don't remember all of their categories, but I think ultimately I opt to a definition of religion that isn't, it's these three things, and if you have them, you're a religion. If you don't, you're not. But more like there's sort of seven or eight broad jobs that various things we have called religions do. And if you're doing four or five of them, I'm comfortable calling you a religion. So I think Judaism has done a lot of those jobs, and I'd like it to continue. So in terms of connecting people to others in community, I think that's important and a good job for Judaism to keep doing. In terms of engaging deeply in celebration and joy through an organized kind of tradition. Judaism does that, and I'd like it to continue doing that. In terms of deep forms of learning and study, which are characteristic of many world religions, Judaism's done that too. So that's what I'm talking about. And yes, I do think that engaging with God and theology is another characteristic of many world religions. And the fact that some systems do it make them more likely to be called religions. But ultimately, I think that Judaism could still be a religion without that being the central point.
Yeah, and I don't think that this is the most important thing that we have to talk about, but just, you know, I kind of resist the word religion for whatever reason, you know, like I'm curious, like, if other people think like me or like you, or there's probably a split, you know, but like for me, a religion connotes some kind of theistic, you know, practice. And I understand that that's not always the case. You know, with certain Eastern religions, for example, you know, but somehow that's how it lands on me, right? And so I'm resistant to the word. So one option is to reinfuse the word with new meaning, right? And the other is to move away from the word. And you know, that is hugely central to our question, right? I mean, our podcast is called Judaism Unbound. You could imagine, right, because we're saying that we want to see the next iteration of Judaism, whether that's a disruptive innovation or a semi-disruptive or, you know, but some kind of new mixing together remix of Judaism that would be the, sort of a next iteration. We've talked about whether that's like 3.8 or 4.0. And you could say, oh, well, that shouldn't be called Judaism. That should be called something else because it's the next iteration. And you know, Dan Mendelsohn Aviv talked about this way back when, you know, that he was very conscious of using the word Judaism to describe what our people's practice has been, you know, since it was founded, knowing full well that Judaism only became the term for it after the destruction of the Second Temple and in Rabbinic Judaism. So prior to that, it wasn't called Judaism. It wasn't really called anything, but it was, academically, we call it Israelite religion.
I agree fully that the term religion turns off a lot of people. I know many of these people, especially in the contexts that I've inhabited in life, both as a social justice activist, where there are lots of people resistant to religion. You know, I'm not queer myself, but in the LGBTQ world, certainly there's a lot of resistance to religion because of just the kinds of oppression that people have experienced. And also just among Jews, I think there's a resistance to the term religion for all sorts of reasons. What I ask myself is, from a quantity standpoint, in terms of numbers of people, are there similar numbers of people or more, and I don't know the answer, for whom the term religion is either actively appealing or in a subconscious way yields positive kinds of engagement that are important? And I see a huge number of people for whom that is the case. First off, we live in our context in America, we are among the most religious countries in the world. Every statistical study that is done indicates that there are a higher percentage of people who regularly do things that we think of as religious and think of themselves as religious than there are in most countries in the world. And the other thing I'd say is that you have a lot of people for whom they might not be living out their religion day to day, but like the fact that they have one seems to like give them a deep kind of curiosity or a reason to connect to their heritage or et cetera. You have people who want deeply to connect to whatever religious heritage they have or religious identity they have in a way that I don't know that they do with other elements of their identity. You have people that, you know, they realize at age 30, you know, I never explored my Jewish identity or my Christian identity or my whatever. And they feel like that's an absence. They feel like that's a loss. And I think it's because we're in a society that places a high value on religion. Now, that's totally changing. All of these things are changing rapidly. And I have no idea if in 50 years or 100 of years, any of this will still be the case. I would not claim at all that we need religion eternally. And I certainly think in the Israeli context, the term religion, dati, is a lost battle and is probably done. Like, I would not defend it. In Israel, where the term is so tied to ultra-Orthodoxy, etc., that it's unsalvageable at this point. But I think it still has a shot in America because of the broader societal context we're in.
Well, Sheriff's story was a really interesting, amazing story. My parents lived in Israel for many years, and my mom passed away about a year ago, and she was in a hospice for a while. And when I came to visit her in the hospice, this wonderful woman came to sit with us, and she was the most kind of warm and soul-inspiring kind of person that, you know, one of the most that I've ever met. And it was so, obviously it was an important time in our lives, and it was so moving, you know, to talk to her. And we were so happy that she came, and she introduced herself as the, I think she called herself, the Melava Ruchanit, which means the sort of spiritual guide or something like that. And she said, you know, in English, you would call me a chaplain, but don't worry, it has nothing to do with religion whatsoever. Absolutely nothing. She like was so, you know, because she was used to Israelis being horrified by the idea that a religious person would come to their bedside, right? You know, and it was so striking that she felt the need to completely distance herself from religion. So that's my question, is whether, not so much whether religion is problematic as much as is there a different framing that we might have, or maybe one of the disruptive innovations that we could play with is other framings that might characterize Judaism in some other way that would be less likely to press the resistance buttons of people that are not participating in Judaism. And because of their non-participation, the word has been kind of poisoned in their mind or given in their mind a set of connotations that they just can't get past.
I think that's a really good point. And I also want to bring up sort of a segmenting that we've talked about before. This won't be new, but there's the non-participants in Judaism or Jewish life who are Jewish. And then there's the non-participants in Jewish life or Judaism who aren't Jewish, but could be attracted in the future to some form of Judaism. And I think on this conversation in particular, it's really important to make that distinction, because among Jews, when they do various polls about religion, and they poll Jews and they poll Christians and they poll atheists and they poll, like, it tends to be, and I'm not looking at one right now, but I'll try to find one for the show notes, it tends to be that Jews are actually really similar to atheists. They're closer to atheists than they are certainly to Protestant Christians and a lot of other groups that are in these polls. And the reason I bring that up is because I think there is a lot of evidence that certainly there would be more of a resistance to the term religion among American Jews than among the rest of Americans. Now, that said, if we open up our future frameworks and paradigms to the possibility that there'd be this influx of a bunch of people who are not currently Jewish into a framework of Judaism, I think there are a ton of people from other groups for whom the term religion is a huge plus. And part of why I'm coming at this is because I lived in Mississippi for 2 years, where even the very progressive, I mean, you do have small pockets of progressives and, like, certainly among various minorities, et cetera. But, like, religion is a really positive thing. People would ask me, what church do you go to? And I'd say Beth Israel. And that was totally acceptable and wonderful. They knew Beth Israel was, you know, quote unquote, the Jewish church in Jackson. And, like, that was great. And they loved that, you know, you had faith, to use a Christian phrasing. But, like, if I had said I don't go to one, that would have been strange. And so, like, in certain areas, I do think that we still have, like, a very positive connotation. And I also think of the framework of what I like to call peer institutions. Like, because so I spend a lot of time following, like, higher education news, and I follow my own alma mater's decision making. And a lot of it comes down to who Brown thinks its peer institutions are. So if we compare ourselves to the 7 other schools in our sports conference, we are impoverished. We have very little money compared to those 7 schools. If we compare ourselves to the rest of the universe, We're among the wealthiest universities in the world. So my question is, how we group our peer institutions is a big deal. So if Judaism sees itself as a religion, and if people see Judaism as religion, then, to spoiler alert an upcoming episode, we speak with somebody who grew up in Christianity and found Judaism, and he's going to speak about how in his own high school so many people ended up in a different religion than they grew up with. This was a Catholic school, and there's lots of people who are no longer Catholic. And to me, people who are dissatisfied with whatever religious upbringing they had, whether it's Christian or Jewish or Muslim, etc., if they're looking for something new, they tend to be looking for another religion. So Judaism has an appeal to those people if they didn't grow up Jewish, because it's also a religion. So, okay, I grew up Christian and didn't like it for whatever reason. I'm going to look at some other stuff that's out there. I'm going to start with Judaism. I'm not going to start with Marxism. Like, at least most people aren't. And I'm not saying that to disparage Marxism. I'm neither good nor bad to this conversation. But I think that there are actually a lot of people who go through that process. And once again, us being in sort of the peer category of religions creates a possibility that people would look to connect. And once again, it's not the point isn't that they disconnect with Judaism and that's great because we want to build numbers. It's the point is it's great because those people are then able to channel the things we believe to be good about Judaism to improve their own lives and the world. And, you know, what's funny, as I say that, it's kind of a big picture direction, you know, talking about Judaism being channeled into the world and ideals for improving lives. And I want to jump into a latter part of our conversation today, which is a look back at the podcast thus far. We've been doing a little bit of this, but because this is our 365th day episode, it seems as important as ever. So I guess, Dan, I was wondering, if you want to kick things off and just talk about, are there any other themes? We've been talking about a few today so far, but are there any others that you want to sort of encapsulate and name here as we head into our second year?
We talked about this with Erwin Kula last week, but really just the entrepreneurs that seem to be most successful in the work that's being done up till now, just the degree to which those new organizations flowed out of their own personal needs. And part of that is saying, like, I think that probably as an investment strategy, if an entrepreneur were coming to you and saying, I want to build this new idea, you know, it probably makes sense to find out if that is actually their own personal need, because they're probably going to be more successful. I mean, that's sort of one way of thinking about it. But I think that the more significant way of understanding that is that those folks are sort of naturally orienting their organization to the jobs to be done that they have in their own lives. So when David Siegelman creates Moshe House out of a deep understanding of, out of his own sense that, you know, he's looking for this way of experiencing Judaism with peers in their flexible ways that they're experiencing it, as opposed to in some kind of way that some other institution is designing, there are a lot of people like him, right? So naturally, that innovation is something that has very wide appeal, even if he didn't sit there with a whiteboard saying, you know, what are the jobs to be done that young Jews in their 20s and 30s have to do in their lives.
Yeah, I agree really deeply with that. And I remember when David Siegelman first brought it up in our Moshe House conversation, and it was such a, it felt kind of obvious and straightforward at the time, but then having it in our lens as we spoke with person after person after person, I mean, it really is the exception to the rule that people didn't fit this model. I'm thinking of Jewish Without Walls. I'm thinking of, you know, Aleph. I'm thinking of all, like, the people we spoke to after that were talking about, you know, I had X issue in my, Bim Bam with Sarah Lufton. I had X issue in my life. I, for whatever reason, decided I was going to fix it instead of just putting my hands up in frustration. And so I then created an organization. That is a really important teaching. And I also think what that demonstrates is that there's a real need for the leadership. I mean, this is what you just alluded to. There's a real need among people that are working in Jewish life to represent a huge, vast set of different kinds of needs. We really, really desperately need people in leadership who have the problems that Sarah Lefton had, where she felt, I have no information. I really have this passion about Judaism, but no grounding. So then she's going to go and make this organization Bim Bam. But we don't just need it so that we can have nice, awesome projects as a result of it. We need it because the very work of the organizations themselves is fundamentally shifted when you have people in positions who get it. Back in our second conversation with B'nai Lapi, she spoke about how, you know, feminist spaces really need to be led by women. Queer spaces, she's wrestling a lot with this, but she still thinks the queer spaces need to be led by folks who are queer, because there is a level of empathizing that we can all and we all must do for those groups. I mean, we're speaking as two guys who are as two non-queer, non-women, but there's something that we can't fully get ever. And for that reason, we're not positioned to take on that kind of role, I don't think. I mean, if somebody asked me to lead a Jewish feminist project tomorrow, like to start it, to be the, like, I would not do it. Like, I don't think that that's my role. But I think we need to think about the extent to which that's true only in issues of like identity versus where it's true in other less charged kinds of issues. Going back to our intermarriage block, even, like, what would it look like if the people looking to engage folks in interfaith relationships were themselves intermarried? I read an article recently about some really great sounding conversation groups in the New York area that are entirely interfaith couples themselves. And as somebody who is in that group, that sounded way more appealing to me than the vast majority of the well-intentioned great work that other organizations are doing, because I know that I will be in a room of people who may not see things exactly the same way I do, but who are at least in the same context, have some of the same experiences. And so that's why I'm sort of bringing it up, because I think it's an issue that cuts across many of the blocks of episodes that we have looked at.
We were going to treat this as two separate parts of today's episode, but I think this is a good place to talk about our experience a little bit, and then I want to come back to this question, but to talk about our experience a little bit launching the podcast, because, you know, I didn't intend for this podcast, and I don't think you did either, to be more than kind of an analytical podcast that talks about, you know, what's going on in the Jewish world and how could it be better. And relatively early on, we started to get emails from people that were saying, you know, listening to your podcast is my Jewish practice. I listen to it every week as I'm jogging and I feel like I'm having a Jewish experience, or, you know, people putting together book club type of things to talk about our podcast and everything. And somehow, you know, we kind of realized that, oh, wow, there seems to be kind of like a community developing here. We didn't set out to do that. And as I'm reflecting upon what we're saying about these other entrepreneurs, I'm realizing, right, that we, or at least I can talk about myself, right? I was trying to solve a problem that I had, which is that, you know, I want to have these conversations. I want to have this sense of open thinking about how Judaism could be better. You know, that I've had these experiences in my life where I feel like I've had a lot of education, so I know what's the potential, but I haven't had a lot of experiences where that potential has been met. And I want to try to like work that through. And when I sort of set out on that, for me, it was just thinking like, yeah, I'd love to do this analytical work to try to think it through. And it turns out that I guess like I'm like more people than I was thinking at the time, right? And realizing that there's a lot of people out there who also want that.
There's a human nature thing that plays into this to some extent. I think for better or for worse, we're all a little bit selfish. And I do mean both better and worse. I'm not saying that entirely cynically. But what that means is, we might have whatever analysis on the table, as we do in this podcast, but certain things are going to stick with us bigger because of our own personal experiences. And look, the nature of the work that we do, especially when we have a little bit of freedom to go in different directions, as we do as a young organization, we're going to go in directions that speak especially to us. I'm a person who, for whatever weird, bizarre reason, loves the holiday of Shavuot. What was the first initiative that we did online to create a holiday initiative to reach people that aren't connecting much with their local communities? It was Shavuot Unbound. Now, I didn't think consciously about that. I didn't, but like, that was something that I had experienced in the past where I had wanted to have a way to engage deeper in Shavuot, but there wasn't really a great format in place for me to do that. And so now we're doing other holidays, but I think that's, and I, once again, I'm not saying this selfish piece because I think it's bad. I think it's how we work to some extent. We might have whatever broad idea we have, but when we start to specify it and work really hard, it gets to the needs that we have. I mean, to bring back Sarah Lefton and Bim Bam, I mean, for a while, she was focused on adult learning and these great Torah portion videos. Then she herself has some young kids and she's working with a lot of people who have young kids. They start this Shaboom, this animated TV show to reach people who are in their own situation. I think that's a reality of how we work. And to steal some of the language we used in the intermarriage conversations, we could fight that reality or we could embrace that, okay, all of us is likely to do a better job and achieve more if we're working on something that really gets our fire going. And that fire is likely to happen from our own personal needs. So let's just determine what those are and do it and have the faith, like you said, that there are other people out there that share the same needs. And I think with our podcast, 100%, we've done that. And it's leading us to start to consider, you know, what it looks like to build communities around the podcast. And that's one thing I'm excited about building over these coming months. And if you're out there listening and you've got even, you know, 2-3 friends that you've had occasional Facebook conversations with or a phone call about our podcast, like, I'd love you to consider what would it look like to meet once a month or every couple of weeks and dig a little deeper, because we're excited to start exploring the possibilities of that moving forward.
Yeah, and I want to actually like segue from that to kind of another thing that I'm thinking about as I look back, because it also connects to what you just said as a potential road toward a solution, which is that now that we have done a full year of the podcast, I think that despite there being a lot of tremendously creative new things going on in the Jewish world, many of whom we've looked at and many of whom we will look at going forward, I worry that they're not disruptive enough. And I think that that's natural, right? Because who's likely to become, you know, a Jewish entrepreneur? It's probably somebody who's not that distant from the organized Jewish institutions. So, you know, if you're a little bit out of it, you're still probably highly motivated to say, but I want to be part of it. And you could go in two directions. One is to say you could sort of be a more marginal participant of existing institutions, or you can be a central participant in a new institution which you create. And that's where the other piece that I've really experienced over this last year comes in, and it connects a little what you were talking to about folks getting together and talking about our podcast, is that one of the things that I didn't come in to this year fully feeling, although I think that you felt it much more than I did, was the power of the internet in this whole story. You know, that that I've talked about before, that Yitz Greenberg has talked about these different phases, these different eras of Judaism, as that in each era, God takes a further step back, and that leaves more responsibility on human beings. And as a result, we need more human beings to shoulder that responsibility. That's Yitz Greenberg's kind of theological view of Jewish history. And I think that dovetails really well with how we started the podcast today, too, talking about monotheism, because it really is this point at which, you know, well, whether we're moving towards atheism or God optional, God is clearly faded even a little bit further back into this experience of all this, and that leaves us shouldering more responsibility. And when Yitz Greenberg was talking about this, you know, 30, 40 years ago, he understood that to mean that the lay leaders of Jewish organizations are sort of our new rabbis. They're the ones who are going to, they're an expanded group who are going to really shoulder this responsibility. But I think that the digital age is what really blows that open even further and says, no, the people who are going to shoulder this responsibility is every Jew, right? Every Jew is going to be a rabbi now. Every Jew has the opportunity because of the amazing access to information that Google allows and the internet allows, and the amazing creativity that the internet allows, and the amazing way that you can form community with people who physically aren't anywhere near you, right? And all these tools have the potential to allow everybody to play with this stuff in a profoundly powerful way.
Yeah, I think that's a really great point. And not right away, but in the coming months, we're going to be furthering these conversations that we're starting in this episode, or maybe continuing from past episodes today, but we're going to continue them in the future, especially when we have a block of episodes leading up to Shavuot with a number of folks from Silicon Valley, where we can really take a look at how their work is happening out there, and then we can, in conversation, apply that to the Jewish world that we've been talking about for, you know, 365 days now. And we want to close the episode, as we have every episode of this last year, this last 365 days, by encouraging you, imploring you, begging you, asking you, suggesting to be in touch with us. And there are a number of ways for you to do that. First, you can head to our Facebook page, Judaism Unbound. Second, you can head to our website, judaismunbound.com, which over the past year has really expanded to include show notes for all of our current episodes, and it will also include show notes for all of our future episodes. We've started the process of getting full transcripts, so you can have written out the full text of some of our episodes. We have a few of those rolled out already, and we'll have more in the future. And last but not least, you can always send us a note via email at dan@nextjewishfuture.org or lex@nextjewishfuture.org. The last request we always make is that you can support us financially with a donation either on a month-to-month basis, repeated, or just one time. And you can do that at judaismunbound.com/donate. So thanks so much for listening. This has been an incredible first year. And with that, this has been Judaism Unbound.